delivery job earnings nowhere near enough for them to get by, they ended up in a position no one wants to find themselves.
I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Karina's quest for help led her to Educare Family Support Service, one of many publicly funded companies helping families down on their luck in the age of COVID.
We have lots of different food items that will go in. The plan behind it was that we would be able to prepare hampers for families, who disadvantaged families who may not be able to afford to have a Christmas meal or Boxing Day meal. So we've ensured that we've provided a hamper with everything excluding the meat. At the moment, we're on about 270. Literally, that is 270 families.
270 of many more families facing food insecurity and hunger, exacerbated by the pandemic, a situation that's drawn in UNICEF for the first time in its 70-year history in this country.
In these unprecedented times, I would imagine that these families have become known to their professionals that they're engaging with and are now require additional support.
This cavernous space is the interior of an Anglican church in West London. In normal times, it would see worshippers kneeling in prayer. Today, it's dedicated to something more pressing, getting food into people's cupboards.
I got quite emotional, actually, about, you know, just the thought that you're privileged and get to enjoy Christmas and then other people are going without, especially at the moment with these troubled times. So I thought if I can come and make just a little bit of difference.
These hampers are being stuffed with supplies to last families for a few days. People used to go to food banks to pick them up. Since the onset of COVID, the whole project of compassion has taken on a new dimension, deliveries.
These volunteer drivers will be dropping off food and presents at hundreds of households for the next 3 days. A drop in the bucket considering the number of families depending on these supplies. And some of those families have up to 6 children.
Most of these volunteers found out about this project on social media. Some of them have dedicated their only day off to being here.
To see the family smiles and the people who need the things is, you know, I can't explain what you feel. The smile of them faces just can give me the energy. They can make my day.
Some have brought their young ones along so they can see firsthand what their less fortunate peers are going through. Those with bigger vehicles have come as couples to help transport more of this humanitarian assistance to homes where kitchen cabinets are not restocked as often as they should.
It's nothing for me to offer a couple of hours, so we are also in a position where it could be me who needs this support.
This year has been very contrasting in the fact that there's some people just getting richer and richer and richer, and we're reaching rock bottom, really, in sense of community is getting destroyed, really.
If you're feeding a family of 4 to 6 people, that's going to last, 2 days. It will get them through till Christmas Eve, hopefully.
And we all think we're struggling. Karina has had to adapt to her new world, caring for her 3-year-old daughter in a small rented apartment with no garden while her husband works, and looking after her ailing father who lives on his own.
I know a lot of people are suffering during this difficult time. It's very challenging, but you have to be positive at all times. Seek for help. If you don't ask, you don't get it.
Karina is perhaps one of the tens of thousands of families, if not more, for whom survival depends on charitable donations. Saeed Pourriza, London.
Christmas Eve 2020, Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed off on an historic post-Brexit trade and security agreement with the European Union after an intense 24-hour negotiation period. A press conference expected early in the day finally came in the afternoon after lawyers and translators had crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion. A year, a comprehensive Canada-style free trade deal between the UK and the EU, a deal that will protect jobs across this country, a deal that will allow goods, UK goods and components to be sold without tariffs and without quotas in the EU market, a deal which will, if anything, allow our companies and our exporters to do even more business with our European friends.
A deal will mean Britain finally leaving the bloc's single market and customs union in a week, and freedom of movement will end. It also settles the future arrangements on a vast range of issues, from aviation and transport to civil nuclear cooperation and energy. The sticking points that took Brexit to the brink of no deal was access to British fishing waters, a contentious issue that prompted the UK to send Navy ships to the English Channel in case of clashes, and the level playing field, which is an important part of the EU single market, allowing for fair and open competition. The negotiations were very difficult, with lots at stake for many, and it was an agreement worth fighting for. Will allow us to avoid major disruptions to workers, businesses and travellers after January 1st. It will protect European interests, and this agreement is also, I believe, in the interests of the United Kingdom. It will lay solid foundations for a new start with long-time friends, and finally, it will ensure we can leave Brexit behind us. Europe continues to move forward. Despite the collective sighs of relief and resignation across Britain, the devil is in the detail. French media made waves in the hours leading up to it by asserting the UK had made huge concessions, something Westminster was quick to deny. Hardline Tory Brexiteers from the European Research Group have said its star chamber of lawyers will be convened to analyse the proposed agreement, suggesting it's not over yet. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Pakistan had a fresh round of negotiations with the UAE in an effort to repair lingering strained relations between the two countries. Pakistan has been under pressure from the UAE to normalize ties with the apartheid state of Israel since August this year, when Abu Dhabi recognized Tel Aviv. For the first time, Islamabad publicly admitted about the existence of a lingering UAE demand to Pakistan to grant diplomatic recognition to Israel, something which Islamabad rejected after the country's foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi.
I have abundantly made it clear to the UAE that Pakistan under no circumstances can establish diplomatic ties with Israel until a permanent and durable solution is found to the Palestinian issue. I have told them about anti-Israeli public sentiments in Pakistan and reminded them of the similar nature of dispute between Kashmir and Palestine.
Foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi has followed suspension of visas to Pakistani citizens after alleged behind-the-scenes threats to Islamabad to replace its 1.5 million expatriates if Pakistan resisted pressure to normalize ties with Tel Aviv.
Pakistan made its position clear because of the mounting pressure from some of the Islamic countries. The problem for Pakistan is that at the public level, at the people level, it is very difficult to sell this idea of giving recognition to Israel, because for decades, Pakistani people have been steadfastly supporting the cause of the Palestinian people.
Despite close brother relations with the UAE, tens of thousands of people protested against Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with Tel Aviv. Israel has been desperate to normalize ties with Pakistan, hoping that if it happens, other Islamic countries would also follow the suit. However, observers say that Israel's effort through UAE and Saudi Arabia to create compelling conditions against Pakistan to normalize ties have fallen flat. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The United Nations Security Council has held a virtual meeting to review the 10th report into the implementation of Resolution 2231, which endorses the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. During the session on Tuesday, Iran's permanent representative to the UN slammed the United States for not only failing to honor its own obligations under the resolution, but also obstructing the implementation of the commitments by other signatories. Takravanchi explained that in the past 4 years, the U.S. has imposed over 1,500 sanctions against Iran, targeting almost all sectors of Tehran's economy and cutting nearly all dividends from the nuclear agreement for Iran. He also referred to the humanitarian impacts of the sanctions on Iran, saying the embargoes are affecting the most vulnerable people in the country.
The United States claim that humanitarian goods are exempt from sanctions is an absolute lie. As an example, even today, we cannot easily import medicine for relieving the breathing problems of those injured by chemical weapons, which were provided by some Western countries to Saddam and used by him during his aggression against Iran.
The Iranian ambassador reiterated Tehran's stance that any proposal for the revision, renegotiation, or extension of the JCPOA is against the UN Resolution 2231 and absolutely unacceptable.
Iran has paid a heavy price and has done much more than its fair share to preserve the JCPOA. Therefore, no one can expect us to do more.
Takravanchi further said that the deal cannot be linked to anything outside of the nuclear program, such as Iran's missile capabilities.
To develop a conventional missile program is an inherent right of any country under international law, and Iran is no exception. Consequently, Iran will not negotiate its legitimate ballistic missile program.
The Security Council session came a day after the foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the JCPOA held a virtual meeting and reiterated their commitments to preserving the agreement. China and Russia in particular call on the U.S. to unconditionally return to the deal and lift its unilateral sanctions against Iran. This comes more than 3 weeks after the Iranian parliament passed a bill that requires the Iranian government to suspend more commitments under the nuclear deal in case sanctions continue. Iran started scaling back some of its commitments a year after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal. Tehran has time and again rejected any preconditions for reviving the agreement, noting that it will go back to full compliance once all the other parties to the court uphold their own end of the deal.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
The third point is that despite the foolish desires of the prattling, despicable, treacherous, and criminal U.S. officials, we will overcome problems with the power of faith and national determination, and we will improve our conditions, God willing. We will use the very same sanctions to make our country resistant. In other words, the sanctions will make our country resistant, and we will be able to create an economy of resistance in the true sense of the word. I have said this many times, and I wish to repeat it, so that activists in different areas, both economic and non-economic, know that the cure for all problems exists inside the country. Many of our problems originate from outside the country, but the cure for them exists inside the country. No one should seek the cure for problems outside the country. We will not receive any good thing from outside the country. The cure exists in the country.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. grant me faith to be stronger.
Cure is domestic acumen and domestic endeavor. The cure lies in adopting the correct outlook and calculations towards the domestic and regional issues of the country, and this should be done inside the country. We should do so by utilizing the power of wisdom and by benefiting from firm determination. It is quite possible to overcome problems. God willing, and the prattle and nonsensical words uttered by the thugs dominating the U.S. nation should not occupy anyone's mind. Well, let us return to the subject of the armed forces. I wish to offer some recommendations. One recommendation is about the academies. One important task is that we should know that threats against countries, both against our country and against others, are constantly changing. What exists as a military threat today was not necessarily considered as a threat 20 years ago.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Kitty, good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Thank you.
supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Hopes that Lebanon would have a new government before the end of the year have been dashed, with Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri warning of clear complications hindering the birth of the new leadership. Speaking on Wednesday after his 14th meeting with President Michel Aoun, Hariri said that despite attempts to halt Lebanon's collapse, the existing political problems are clear. International pressure, especially from France, for Beirut to draw up a government committed to reform has also failed to end the stalemate. The political impasse raises fears over Lebanon's growing poverty levels, with a number of poor likely to exceed half the population by the year 2021. The country has been without a government since August, after then-caretaker Premier Hassan Diab resigned following a deadly port blast in the capital, Beirut. For more on that story, we're first joined by our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who's with us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, with an update. Mariam, what are these complications that the Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri has mentioned?
Well, basically, Zaatari, I think he has reached a state where he knows that he cannot form a government on his own. And this is what this is something he was trying to push for without getting the consent of other parliamentary blocs. And namely, he needs to get the consent of the president. And it seems the president has several remarks on the way, whether the method of forming the government, which Prime Minister Hariri is going through, or even the names of the cabinet ministers, how the portfolios are being divided. Now, it's true that most blocs have agreed that we need to get out of the sectarian system. However, in light of the current parliament, president is stressing, and other parliamentary blocs are also stressing, that he would need to get the prime minister would need to get the consent of the parliamentary blocs, which are unfortunately divided based on sectarian basis. However, it seems there are other complications. Some analysts are saying that Prime Minister Saad Hariri is actually waiting for the term of U.S. President Donald Trump to end, and when we have a new president in the U.S., then perhaps there would be less pressure on Lebanon, on its government, in order to isolate Hezbollah and not include them in a government, or at least not include people who are allies of Hezbollah or close to them in the current government. Now, this will all, of course, show after the new year, but for now, we don't seem to have any sign that we will be forming a government, of course.
All right, thanks a lot, Mariam. That was our correspondent, Mariam Sola, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also joining us on this debate, we have activist and political commentator Laith Maarouf, who's also with us from the Lebanese capital.
Okay.
Mr. Maarouf, welcome to the program. Well, Saad Hariri said that despite attempts to halt Lebanon's collapse, the existing political problems are clear. What is the nature of these stumbling blocks?
The nature of the stumbling blocks for forming a government right now is specifically the demands coming from the imperial powers, which is that they don't want to have Hezbollah represented in the government, and they want to break the alliance between the Free Patriotic Movement, the party that the president only belongs to and is a founding member of. And this is unacceptable, obviously, for the country. The majority of the population are represented by these two parties, and they have a clear majority in the parliament. So to try to exclude those and pretend that you can have what is called a technocrat government, which there's no such thing. Everybody has a political affiliation in this country and on this planet in general. Everybody has a political opinion. So, and the governing of states is politics in its say. So excluding the representatives of Hezbollah or the Free Patriotic Movement means a abandonment of democracy in this country.
Let's bring in lawyer and political commentator Edward Corrigan, who's with us from London, Ontario. Mr. Corrigan, welcome to the program. Looking back at some of the grievances of the Lebanese protesters, one must think, does the Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri wield the solution, or is he himself part of the problem? Mr. Corrigan? All right, I believe we've still not established that connection. I'm going to redirect that question to our guest in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, Mr. Maarouf. Mr. Maarouf, I'm not sure if you got the question there. I'll just repeat it. Is Saad Hariri part of the solution, or is he still part of the problem?
He's definitely part of the problem, especially that he didn't learn the lesson from the previous government that he led. The last time it was, that he was chosen to be prime minister of the country, it ended up with him being kidnapped in Riyadh, strapped to a chair and slapped silly to resign on live broadcast from the capital of Saudi Arabia. And at the time, his skin was saved by Hezbollah and President Aoun. That brought him back safely to this country and allowed him to form a government at the time, given the situation. So Mr. Hariri should have learned at that time that he cannot depend on foreign powers to dictate what kind of government he has to form, and that he should have actually started cooperating with his compatriots in Lebanon and joining the Lebanese consensus in forming a government with Hezbollah and the Free Patriotic Movement.
So basically, is this just a rerun of the past, in your opinion? Has the old political show once again taken center stage with the same players and the same demands?
Definitely. See, Saudi Arabia and the United States were not happy with the outcome of that first Hariri government, national government, and we saw the demonstrations that were triggered by awful decisions made by ministers that were kind of counted on the Saudi camp within that government that Hariri had at the time. We saw the collapse of the country's economy under the pressures of American sanctions and destruction of the banking system. And now Hariri had a chance that was given to him once more by Hezbollah and the Free Patriotic Movement. And I don't know if he learned the lesson. So we're all waiting for either war to start in the region in the next 20 days before the inauguration in the United States, and or a coming of a new president that can lift some of the pressures that allow actually some decision-making to be made in Lebanon without threats of bombings.
Mr. Maruf, you just mentioned Saudi Arabia not being happy with the recent outcome in Lebanon. What was the outcome that they were looking for?
They were looking for either stripping Hezbollah of any representation in the government, which means that the government will be totally under the influence of Saudi Arabia and by extension Israel in the United States, and therefore keeping Hezbollah in a corner in Lebanon under threat, and or for a total collapse of the country with armed conflict in the streets that return to a civil war. We saw that in the last few months with threats from the Falange of arming their militias. So we have, that's what the empire's only choices that are being put forward. Maybe with Biden, things will change.
All right, if I'm correct now, we have Mr. Edward Corrigan back with us, but he's on the line from London, Ontario. Mr. Corrigan, if you're with us, I'm going to address some of the earlier questions to you to get your perspective on the political situation right now in Lebanon. Saad Hariri, he said that despite attempts to halt Lebanon's collapse, the existing political problems are clear. Talk to us about these problems and these complications.
Well, Lebanon is a political mess at the present time. Its economy is in a terrible state. The Lebanese pound has lost 80% of its value against the U.S. dollar, and you have the complication of the big Beirut explosion, which everybody's trying to attribute blame to. And so you have a political situation and economic situation that is, as close to disaster as you can. Now, the politics, Lebanon's politics is very unusual. It's the confessional base, so each religion has a set number of representatives in the parliament. It was originally set up in 1943 with a ratio of 6 Christians to 5 Muslims. But then in the 1989 Taif agreement, they changed it to 50-50, so 50% Christian, 50% Muslim. So you've got a breakdown of all the different groups. Now, the problem is that the Christian population has decreased significantly in Lebanon, and for sure the Muslim population is in a large majority. The Shia population is probably the largest single group in Lebanon, but only has limited power. They're equated with the same power as the Sunnis in Lebanon. And I think everybody would agree that the Shias are much larger than the Sunni population. But the problem with the current, this is like the third attempt government, and Hariri was a former premier of Lebanon when a lot of the problems occurred, and there was rampant corruption and political problems and infighting, with the occasional assassination by various parties, including Hariri's father, who was you know, prime minister of Lebanon and a respected individual and had a lot of money, a lot of ties to Saudi Arabia and that. But now we have a problem where the Hariri put together a list. He supposedly didn't consult with the president, Michel Aoun. And then also some of the parties wanted to have veto power. They wanted to have at least, you know, three of the cabinet positions, which would give them veto over the government. And so they haven't been able to come to an agreement. And you have the party split, but there's no agreement yet with the president or with the premier and, of course, the political parties themselves. So it's been that way for months, and they seem to be unwilling to come to an agreement. And, of course, France is interfering, as is the United States. The United States has put sanctions against several leading Lebanese politicians because they refuse to disown Hezbollah. Hezbollah is one of the largest parties in the parliament, and it represents, has 12 seats out of the Shia population. It's probably the best organized, most powerful political force in Lebanon itself, but of course the Americans don't like that, and of course the Israelis don't like that. But, and as a result, nothing has been resolved to date, and until they get over the petty personal differences, and they really need to reform the political system from front to bottom. And they need to actually break out of this confessional system that locks everybody into their own particular religious community and creates barriers for them to build bridges towards other communities.
Laith Maarouf, Hariri recently met with U.S. Ambassador to Lebanon, who stressed that Hezbollah must not be present in the cabinet, neither directly nor via proxy. In the past, we recall Hezbollah warned that the current U.S. administration is in fact responsible for obstructing efforts to form the government in Lebanon. What are Washington's motives?
Washington's motives is trying to isolate Hezbollah inside Lebanon, and by doing so, hoping that they can agitate enough in the government, if they have control of it and Hezbollah doesn't have any influence, to agitate to disarm them. And we know this is a dead end in Lebanon, and Hezbollah has already made it clear that they will not accept having no representation in the government, given that they won the most seats out of any party in this country. And, you know, although sectarianism in politics is a big problem in Lebanon, even if there's an election that is on a secular basis, there wouldn't be much change in the number of seats that each party that we have right now represented will get. And so the truth of the matter is the problem is not what is written in law, is the how things are implemented. So if a true implementation of either a sectarian electoral system or a secular one happened, Hezbollah should be represented in forming the government, because it is one of the biggest winners along with the patriotic movement of Aoun, the party there. So here is the dilemma. Democracy is allowed by the West only if it results in leadership that is in servitude to the empire. If democracy presents results with sovereignists, like in Bolivia, in Venezuela, in Syria, in Iran, in Lebanon, then those people and their democracy and their state will be targeted.
Mr. Corrigan, regionally, who benefits from uncertainty and instability in Lebanon?
Certainly the Israelis do, because they've always wanted to target Lebanon as the weakest state in the area because of its religious division. The Americans and Bush, or the Trump administration, are trying to, you know, help Israel and extend its own influence. And France is actually interfering in Lebanese politics and making pushes and demands that are inappropriate, quite frankly. But also they're trying to reestablish the old French sort of colonial dominance of the area, which of course is getting pushback from people in Lebanon. But the countries that will benefit are certainly Israel. You could argue also that maybe Saudi Arabia and some of the other Sunni countries who have supported Hariri in the past also, you know, might benefit a little bit. But, you know, out of chaos, there's, I think, opportunity for nobody, really. Israel has constantly been violating Lebanon's, airspace and using it to attack Syria and even launch its own attacks on Lebanon itself. So the Israelis certainly benefit from weak Lebanon, but some of the Western powers who are against supporting Israel also seem to probably benefit from this, and they're trying to force Lebanon to bow to its wishes and exclude Hezbollah, which again, as the previous speaker indicated, is like one of the largest, if not the largest party in Lebanon, and is really the strongest political group in the country. So it's part of the government, and we can't say, oh, they're terrorists. Actually, Hezbollah doesn't meet the definition of a terrorist country. They're defending their own country against a foreign occupier, and have a lot of support even within the Christian community and the other communities that existed in Lebanon. And it's a very fractured country with many different divisions. But and of course, as I said, the demographics are still out of whack, because the Sunnis and the Shia are certainly larger than the Christian population, with the Shias probably being the number one group. But to break out of that rigid formula where you have to compete and get votes only from your own religious group is, I think, a step that Lebanon's going to have to make at one point. But I agree with the previous speaker. The breakdown on nationalism issues and Palestinian issue and sovereignty would probably be very similar to what the current breakup of the Lebanese parliament is. But also there's egos involved where people want to have a veto on the government, or they want to have control of the defense ministry, the finance ministry, whatever. There's a lot of that infighting going on, and as a result, they can't have any agreement. But Aoun's son-in-law is head of the Christian party, and there's a rivalry there between Hariri and Aoun that goes back to the Civil War. So they need to really almost have a clean slate, have new set of politicians that will not have the baggage that the other ones do.
Laith Maruf, let's turn our attention to the round after round of U.S. sanctions against Lebanon. These sanctions have been called an act of aggression against all of Lebanon. Why is the U.S. Piling on the pressure when the nation is so obviously suffering?
Hoping to rally the population against the government and the political elite in Lebanon and create upheaval that either results in the expulsion of Hezbollah from government and or civil war. This is the formula done everywhere. This is the main reason for the use of sanctions as a weapon by the Western powers led by the United States. When we see that happening in Venezuela, we see that happening in Iran and Syria and North Korea and Cuba. Any country that its people are on side with sovereignty will be sanctioned in order to starve that population to the point where they're willing to give in to imperialism and colonization just to be fed. So that's what's happening. And we can see that sanctions haven't worked in Iran, haven't worked in Syria, haven't worked in North Korea, in Cuba, half a century of that. And that's why we're at the stage where apartheid Israel fires four cruise missiles just off Beirut last night, and woke up my children's Christmas night, the Merry Christmas to our Christian viewers around the world, and threats of attacking Iran directly are being made by the United States with the deployment of nuclear submarines in the Gulf. That's even one of the scariest threats that we've
Very
had
well.
Since the Cuban missile crisis.
All right, we're out of time. I'm sorry to interrupt you there. Allow me to thank my guests, a lawyer and political commentator, Edward Corrigan, joining us on the line from London, Ontario. Also, thanks to activist and political commentator, Mr. Laith Maruf, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also, special thanks to you all for staying with us on this debate.
This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Canadians are joining the criminal army of the Israeli regime and putting themselves in the service of war crimes to which they can be held liable, says Nora Barris Friedman Ryder in an article titled, Israeli regime illegally recruits Canadian citizens to its army. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Human rights activists are demanding an end to the Israeli regime military recruitment of Canadians, which violates the laws of that country. The Canadian government has so far refused to enforce its laws, allowing the Zionist regime to continue the practice. Canadians joined Zionist militias during the Nakba, the forced expulsion of Palestinians from their homeland in 1947 and 1948. The Zionist regime army has boasted in recent years that it has enlisted hundreds of Canadian citizens to its occupation military, joining other foreigners, including those from the U.S. The CBC reported last year that Canadian government agencies do not keep track of how many of its citizens join the Israeli regime army. Last year, the Zionist regime's consulate in Toronto said that a representative of its military would be interviewing potential recruits. Legal experts say this is a violation of the Foreign Enlistment Act, which prohibits a foreign state from enlisting Canadian citizens into its armed forces. The act, which passed in 1937, was originally an anti-communist measure to criminalize Canadians who traveled to Spain to help fight against the fascist Franco dictatorship. In mid-October, 170 prominent Canadian faith leaders, activists, artists, and intellectuals called on Justice Minister David Lametti to investigate and potentially take legal action against all those involved in the recruiting and encouraging recruiting in the country for the Israeli regime army. In addition to the prominent Canadian signatories, scholar Noam Chomsky, Pink Floyd Roger Waters, filmmaker Ken Loach, Nobel Peace Laureate Merritt McGuire and journalist Chris Hedges signed the letter. John Pilpot, a criminal litigation attorney and international law expert, filed a formal complaint with Lametti over the Zionist regime's recruitment within Canada. Such recruitment is a crime under the Criminal Code of Canada, Pilpot told the electronic Antifaza. Philpott also called on Lametti to investigate Deborah Lyons, Canada's ambassador to the occupied Palestine, who held a party at the country's embassy in Tel Aviv to honor its citizens serving in the Israeli regime army. Only 33 of the 78 Canadian citizens in the Israeli regime army were able to attend the January event. Many were unavailable because they were deployed to the Golan Heights, Syrian territory occupied by the Zionist regime, and along the Gaza boundary, Canada's defense attache told media. We consider that Lyons potentially is encouraging people to join the Israeli regime army and could be charged, Philpott said. Nearly 1,500 people have sent letters to the Lametti demanding that recruiting schemes be stopped. Lametti deferred responsibility to the police. It is necessary that the diplomats from another country, therefore the diplomats of Israel who are here, follow Canadian law, he said. It is up to the police investigators to decide whether there have been offenses and, if there is one, for the prosecutor to proceed with formal charges. Following Justice Minister Lametti's response, Philpott sent a complaint to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in early November. The RCMP acknowledged receipt of the complaint, according to Philpott. Canada's pro-Israeli regime policies, including its opposition to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement for Palestinian rights, are out of step with public opinion. A September poll found that 86% of Canadians do not want the Israeli regime to be held to a different standard than other countries. The fact that illegal recruiting by Israeli regime can happen here with impunity is a reflection of the overall situation. Bruce Katz, co-president of the group Palestinian and Jewish Unity, told the electronic Intifada, "We are dealing with a very well-organized, well-funded machine," Katz added, referring to the Israeli regime lobby groups that have a distorting influence over Canadian policy. They can be held liable. Philpott said that leaders of schools who promote a student enlistment into the Israeli regime army could be liable to charges. Various lone soldier programs attract and sponsor international recruits to the Zionist regime military. As reporter Yves Engler has noted, some Jewish schools in Toronto, for example, incorporate promotion of the Zionist regime troops and army officials into their curricula. The Zionist regime lobby groups also promote the regime's military propaganda at Canadian universities. In November 2019, Palestine rights activists were physically attacked by far-right extremists at York City in Toronto when they protested an event glorifying Israeli regime troops. The event featuring reservists on duty, a group created to defend the Zionist regime army and counter the Israeli regime boycott movement at university campuses, was hosted by Herut, a Canadian Zionist organization. The organizers billed the event as an opportunity to hear from real Zionist regime troops. Philpott said that human rights advocates should continue to document and protest these recruitment schemes. Canadians are joining a criminal army and putting themselves in the service of war crimes to which they can be held liable, Philpott warned.
Good morning. morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.